from the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. There's a town in a farming region of northern Syria on the main road from Damascus to Aleppo called Khan Sheikhoun. Now, in April, this town, which is controlled by rebels, made international news when President Bashar al-Assad's air force dropped bombs containing sarin nerve agent on its people. The attack killed around 100 people, many of them civilians, and injured hundreds more. The U.S., of course, responded by launching cruise missiles on one of Assad's airfields. Yet the dropping of sarin at Khan Sheikhoun has highlighted the continuing threat from chemical and biological weapons and showcased the limits of international efforts to halt their use. So on this edition of Global Journalist, we're going to talk about the development and use of these weapons and how the threats from them are changing. Now, in a few minutes, we'll be joined by a panel of experts who have tracked this issue from a few different angles. But first, we're joined from Arlington, Virginia, by Daniel Gerstein. He's a retired Army colonel and former senior official at the Department of Homeland Security. He's worked on preparations and planning for these types of attacks. Currently, he's a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. Daniel, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, let's just review the difference between chemical and biological weapons. The anthrax letters, which many of our listeners may remember, sent back in 2001, they were an example of a biological agent. This sarin agent used in Syria is a chemical weapon. Is that right? Tell us just a bit about the differences between the two.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, many times people try to use the two interchangeably. While there might be some similarities, there are also some pretty significant differences. Let me just highlight a couple of the similarities and differences. You know, both trace their roots back to the antiquities, ancient programs, things like the use of poisons in the case of chemical, in the case of biological, having bodies, diseased bodies catapulted into enemy camps. When we look at the two, chemical and biological, they really trace their modern roots to the early 1900s. In the case of chemical, of course, it's a little earlier, and then World War I saw the massive use of chemical munitions, hundreds of thousands of casualties. In the case of biological, it really started approximately in 1935 with the Japanese unit 731. Both of them are at times classified as weapons of mass destruction, somewhat an unhelpful characterization in many cases. You can have both with lethal or incapacitating capabilities. The major difference between the two, though, is that chemicals and their precursors are derived. They can be chemical munitions or they can be toxic industrial chemicals, whereas biological pathogens are those pathogens which exist in nature. We sometimes talk about them as being living, although that's not necessarily the case. You've got bacteria, which are living organisms, viruses and fungi and toxins, which are not necessarily considered to be living.
Well, Daniel, I wanted to ask you, for nuclear weapons, there is a fairly well-known treaty called the Non-Proliferation Treaty that limits nuclear weapons to the five nuclear states, calls for eventual disarmament. Is there this type of international agreement that governs the use of chemical weapons, the use of biological weapons?
There is indeed. There are two separate conventions. For chemicals, it's called the Chemical Weapons Convention. It entered into force in 1993, and it prohibits the use of chemical munitions in warfare. I will say, however, there's still there is a carve out that allows for use of chemicals and in terms of riot control agents for biological.
You mean weapons, like tear gas?
Like tear gas.
Okay.
For biological, there is the unequivocal norm. It's called the Biological Weapons Convention, and it absolutely prohibits the use of biological pathogens or their derivatives in warfare. Again, there's somewhat of a carve-out in that you are allowed to use pathogens for peaceful, preventive, or prophylactic purposes in accordance with the convention.
And just specifically about the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons, back in 2013, of course, Assad did use chemical weapons. There was President Obama's famous sort of red line, if you will, and then the agreement to disarm, destroy those stockpiles in Syria. And then we see him using them again 3 years later. So where did these chemical weapons come from if they were supposedly destroyed a couple years ago?
Well, it appears that the regime did not comply with the agreement that had been reached. We also know that in Syria, there has been the use of what we call toxic industrial chemicals. Think about chlorine or ammonia. And so even if they gave up all of those stocks, there would still be the potential for industrial chemicals to be used in a massive sort of way in an attack.
So in other words, when it comes to chemical weapons, then there are some chemicals maybe that are specifically used to sort of poison people in warfare, but others that have dual uses, like you mentioned chlorine, which is in bleach.
That's correct.
Well, let's talk about biological weapons then. What are some of the common ones? We talked about anthrax, but how difficult is it to produce these?
Well, some of the more common ones are anthrax, tularemia or rabbit fever, Clostridium botulinum, which is a nerve agent or a nerve neurotoxin. Also smallpox, although that no longer exists in nature. The only known stocks are in Russia and the United States. So that's some of the types of pathogens that had been used in the former U.S. program and in the former Soviet and then Russian programs. In terms of how easy or hard it is, what I would say is that it used to take, back when we had an offensive program, it really took people in the lab with good hands to be able to do a lot of the manipulations. But what we are seeing today is that given the democratization, that is the proliferation of biological technology, you're seeing an increasing number of people with the potential to use biotech for nefarious purposes. You know, for example, there are now neighborhood labs. You have the DIY or do-it-yourself movement where people are doing it in garages. And they're learning how to manipulate some very, very complex biological processes. And this is something that is of concern to those in the community who think about these issues. On the other hand, we don't want to see legitimate science, legitimate work on biotechnology and the living organism stop, because at the end of the day, that's how we get discovery and innovation.
Well, our time does grow short. We do have just about 30 seconds left, but tell us, if you would, about what the U.S. programs are for chemical weapons and for biological weapons. What types of weapons do we have? What types of research are we doing right now?
So we absolutely do not do any sort of offensive work with either chemical or biological weapons. That is forbidden. We do not have those programs. So that's a very, very important foundation that's in accordance with international and U.S. law. But we do engage in defensive work to ensure that we are prepared. So, for example, I was in Department of Homeland Security. We had a specialized laboratory that allowed us to do bioforensics in case there was an attack, or to be able to do threat assessments in case we saw something that was of concern, we could try to understand it in a laboratory environment. So conducting those threat assessments was absolutely key. There are programs that are run particularly by the Army that do defensive work to protect our forces who might be overseas and in harm's way. Everything from medical countermeasures, vaccines, all the way up to protective gear and systems for conducting environmental sampling. So our programs are purely defensive in nature. And, you know, what we hope to do is to be able to deter, and if not being able to deter, to be able to ensure that we are prepared in the event someone does use these sorts of weapons.
Well, Daniel Gerstein, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Certainly. Thanks for having me.
A reminder that you're tuned in to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking today about the evolving threats from chemical and biological weapons and international efforts to prevent their use. To broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in three other people who have been tracking these issues closely. Joining us from Leeds in the United Kingdom is Edward Spears. He's a professor of strategic studies at the University of Leeds and author of the 2010 book, A History of Chemical and Biological Weapons. Joining us from Berlin, Germany, is Sarah Everts. She's a senior editor at Chemical and Engineering News, a weekly news outlet published by the American Chemical Society. And in Newark, New Jersey, is Leonard Cole. He's the director of the Program on Terror Medicine and Security at Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School, and the author of the book, The Anthrax Letters. Welcome to all of you. Leonard Cole, let me start with you. Let's back up just a bit. Most people, when they think of chemical biological weapons, they think of them sort of as creations of the 20th century. Now, as Daniel Gerstein had mentioned briefly, there's actually sort of a long history of the use of these weapons.
Yes, indeed. Beside Daniel Gerstein's excellent overview, I would suggest or add that there was for centuries, for millennia, a lack of differentiation between a biological weapon and a chemical weapon or a poison. They were both called poisons. That largely changed in the late 19th century when Louis Pasteur, a French scientist, actually discovered that it was the microorganisms of various sorts, bacteria in particular in the beginning, and then later on in future decades, viruses, fungi, that were separately a category by way of their ability to reproduce and cause disease. So it's really, as Dan said, only in the early part of the 20th century that you began to see the use of these in a differentiated way. But the truth is that thousands of years ago, people were engaged in biological terrorism or warfare by dropping dead animals into the wells where people would draw water from. And don't forget the famous poisoning of Socrates by taking hemlock, which is a plant derivative, but it was ultimately seen as a poison. So these materials have been around for a long time.
Well, I'm sorry, if I could turn this to Sarah Everts then. Well, one of the issues also that Daniel mentioned was the use of chemical weapons and poison gas on an industrial scale during World War I. You wrote extensively about this Nobel Prize-winning German chemist who sort of viewed as the father of chemical weapons. What did he do? How did he justify their use?
In the early weeks of World War I, the German army had great success. It was moving across Europe. But as the Allies ramped up their defense, the war became a war of trench warfare. And both sides were mired in really muddy trenches. Neither could get the upper hand. And Fritz Haber, who is a famous chemist already because he had figured out how to make fertilizer from nitrogen in the air, approached the German military and said, let us try using poisonous gas, in particular chlorine, which was used quite heavily in the German dye industry. It was used to make dyes. And many of the military leaders were skeptical. They thought it sounded like a stunt to release chlorine from cylinders. But Fritz Haber managed to convince one commander, a commander at Flanders Fields, to let him try it out. And they had to wait for weeks. They dug over 5,000 cylinders of chlorine along the trenches and waited for the wind to blow towards the Allies, and it took quite some time. And when it finally did happen, the Allies had no idea what was coming. Many reports say that they saw this yellow greenish gas that floated across no man's land, and curiosity turned to terror as people began to feel the effects, which is effectively asphyxiation. Chlorine in your lungs turns into a strong acid, and it's really terrible. And effectively, it was so successful, it even surprised Fritz Haber himself. They decimated several Canadian and French troops, and the problem was that the German army did not have backup, so they didn't ever even actually capitalize on their success. But very quickly, many people on both sides started investigating further use of poisonous weapons. There is over 5,000 compounds considered, more than 50 used on the battlefield. But I think one German soldier named Rudolf Binding said it best when he heard what had happened at Flanders Fields, this first release of chlorine gas and the effects it had. He said, "I am not pleased with the idea of poisoning men. Of course, the whole world will rage about it at first and then imitate us." And that was pretty much what happened. Even though the German army, led by Fritz Haber, initiated many of the major gases used in World War I, chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas, quickly the Allies figured out what the chemicals were and used them right back on the Germans.
Well, that's a good jumping off point, because I wanted to talk to Edward Spears. Then there was this widespread revulsion at the effects of chemical weapons, of gas, during World War I. That didn't stop various countries from manufacturing, stockpiling them, and using them later on in the 20th century as well. Take us forward up to the present day, up to Syria. What are some of the other major incidents that have involved the use of chemical and biological weapons?
Well, they were used, of course, by the Italians in Ethiopia in the 1930s, part of chemical colonial warfare there. They were also, of course, used by the Japanese in Manchuria in the late 1930s, heavily stockpiled by all the principal belligerents during the Second World War, where deterrence through a threat of retaliation in kind seems to have kept everybody in check, along with considerable intelligence misperceptions.
So in World War II, they weren't used on the battlefield in Europe. Obviously, they were used during the Holocaust by the Germans, but we didn't see their use sort of in warfare on the battlefield in the way that they were in World War I.
No, there are some speculation that there may be a minor usage between the Poles and the Germans, but really nothing to compare with the First World War. And after the war, chemical weapons and indeed biological weapons, which had been developed during the Second World War, and not least by the Brits, become stockpiled as part of the Cold War buildup between the Soviet Union and the Western adversaries. Allegations of biological warfare in Korea, but those allegations, I think, have been pretty comprehensively dismissed by John Van Cortlandt Moon. On the other hand, chemical weapons have been used, and there was a spectacle in the Middle East of them being used in the Yemen. Extensive dissemination of chemical protective kit was found during the Six-Day War, which led, of course, to speculation that the Russians had been distributing these materials among their allies. Chemical weapons also used, of course, in Vietnam. Tear gas and herbicides were extensively. And subsequent to Vietnam, despite the reining back of the American programs in the wake of the controversies they caused, we find considerable proliferation of chemical weapons, particularly in the 1980s, and most extensive use in the Iran-Iraq War. The eight-year war of that period, used certainly by the Iraqis, perhaps less so by the Iranians.
If I could just stop you there, we do need to just remind our listeners that they're listening to Global Journalist. We're talking today about the evolving threats of chemical and biological weapons. From anthrax to sarin nerve gas, these kinds of weapons have proven difficult to contain. We're joined today by Edward Spears of the University of Leeds, Sarah Everts of Chemical and Engineering News, and Leonard Cole, the director of the Program on Terror Medicine and Security at Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School. If you're interested in more Global Journalists, you can visit our website, globaljournalist.org. There you can access our archives and find our ongoing reports on undercovered international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or subscribe to the program on YouTube or iTunes. And Leonard Cole, we did get some good background now on chemical weapons. Tell us just briefly about the development of biological weapons. These weapons obviously have been considered beyond the pale for a century or more. What is specifically dangerous about these? Are these weapons that are more likely to be used by individuals or terrorist groups rather than by states?
This is a very good question, and it's not entirely answerable. The only bioterrorism attack that we've experienced in the United States was via the anthrax letters. Here and there, there have been reports of individuals trying to either use botulinum toxin or ricin, which these are toxin agents that are derived from plant sources, therefore biological. Part of the problem is what I call the biological paradox. Biological weapons are the only kind, the only sort, that once exposed to the weapon, in this case a biological agent, it is still possible to prevent serious harm to a person. If somebody's infected, you can have an antibiotic if it's appropriate to this particular organism that's affecting them, or a vaccine. A variety of defensive efforts are available, unlike with others. On the other hand, they pose an anxiety attitude by many that if you think you've been exposed to a biological agent and it has an incubation period of a week or two or three, you may worry a great deal about whether you've become infected, and the doctors who are seeing you might well worry at the same time. So unlike other agents, biologicals have this special capability of being vulnerable to protection by individuals who've been exposed, and also cause a great deal of anxiety. And if they are contagious and they are infectious and lethal, they can cause massive damage. Millions and millions of people can be affected by an epidemic or a pandemic
Sarah Everts, if I could turn this to you then, one of the issues that I understand has come to the fore with respect to the use of biological weapons is that the technology, particularly in the biological sciences, has advanced very rapidly. There's a new technique for altering bacteria, for altering DNA, called gene editing, which has a lot of uses for civilian purposes, for producing different agricultural crops, but it can also be used to change diseases and their pathogens. What sorts of risks or dangers does this mean in this realm, in biological weapons?
Well, you can weaponize them. You can make the bacteria possibly more stronger or resistant to some things that you would try against it, some defenses. But I guess the concern is that biotechnology is increasingly is getting increasingly easier to do, and so many more people in home labs have the ability to work with these organisms, with their genetic material, and you know, to effectively weaponize them.
So this is something then that it sounds like it's more simple to create than a nuclear bomb, where you need centrifuges and you need uranium or something like that. This is something that would be more accessible for, say, a small group of people to obtain.
Possibly. I've never tried to do it myself. But yes, you don't need radioactive materials per se necessarily. But chemical weapons suffer the same facility as well. I mean, both are chemical weapons often, or some of them, come from industrial chemicals, as one of our panel members already mentioned, which, you know, if you have a chemical industry in a country, these chemicals can be used for good or for bad.
Well, Edward Spears, what's your view on this development of biological weapons? We'd mentioned earlier that there's sort of a dual-use capability to doing this kind of research, where if you're researching how to make vaccines to protect your population from biological weapons, that vaccine, that research can be easily translated into making an offensive weapon. Is there some inherent tension?
I don't think there's necessarily a tension, but it's certainly the case that if you're going to devise appropriate defensive technology, both injections, both protective suits, protective equipment generally, then you've got to know how they could possibly be used in an offensive or a terrorist context. And so this does require some considerable thought being given by bodies like Fort Detrick in the United States, Portland Down in Great Britain, to reflecting on the evolving way in which these agents can be used by the sort of people who might be still inclined to experiment or actually use them in operational circumstances.
And Leonard Cole, you work at a medical school and are focused on developing responses to these kinds of attacks. Are there some sort of specific, unique ethical issues surrounding this kind of research? Or does it pose some particularly difficult questions for researchers?
I would say that the people who are researching are under great security requirements that have been developed since the anthrax attacks back in 2001. I have very close associations with people who work on what are called select agents, the types that could conceivably be biological agents. They're scrutinized carefully. Their laboratories are overseen carefully. So there is a concern, and therefore, I think, a productive effort to try to control a wayward or an unsavory character from developing these kinds of weapons in a regular laboratory.
And give us just a sense, if you would, about how prepared the U.S. is, about how prepared sort of the major hospitals in the country are to sort of combat this type of attack, should it take place.
I think, in general, we're not terribly well prepared. Part of the difficulty, and it's an understandable difficulty, is that, for example, immediately after the anthrax attacks back in 2001, and then continuing into 2002 with the aftermath, We ramped up federal spending for protection and also for developing countermeasures and inner general awareness. That's fallen off a bit because we haven't had any major issues that have hit the front pages of the papers. And so we go about our daily lives, including doctors who don't really pay too much attention to this. And I do believe that education is required and a continuing sense of awareness. We're not altogether where we should be in that area.
And Sarah Everts, our time does grow short, but where do you see these issues moving over the next 3 years, over the next 5 years? Obviously, many people were surprised to see that chemical weapons were used in Syria. Is it likely that the dynamic around this issue is going to change?
I can't predict the future. I think the real concern is that particularly with chemical weapons, although there are antidotes, say, for nerve agents like sarin that was used in Syria, the problem is that you need to deliver them within minutes, like under an hour, in order for them to actually be able to protect people. And so although there's a lot of development of, say, gas masks and protective equipment and also antidotes, all of these things need to be either given prophylactically or given very soon after exposure. And for most recent attacks, it's been civilians, not just in Syria, but if you think about the Tokyo subway attack. And, you know, it's not going to ever happen that you're going to have civilians walking around a city carrying around gas protection, chemical weapons protection. And so I think the real threat is to civilians, particularly in the future.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Our thanks to Daniel Gerstein, Edward Spears, Sarah Everts, and Leonard Cole for joining us. This week's show is produced by Rachel Foster Gimble, with assistance from Trevor Hook and Needham Kasaye. Pat Akers is our audio engineer, and Travis McMillan is our director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.